Yes. So, thanks again for joining us. We will be discussing the history of replica symmetry breaking, which we roughly bound from 1975 to 1995 in physics. But before we get to that, we have a few questions sort of leading up to this in your particular context,
Right.
to try to enrich your biographical context. In your Nobel biography, you explained why you ended up at Berkeley, but not really what drew you to particle physics. Was it then your only scientific interest in physics, or were there other subfields, such as solid-state physics, for instance, that were on your radar?
So, no, at the time, I was interested in fundamental questions in physics. And at that time, so different from today's time, particle physics was clearly the frontier. My exposure to solid state physics was minimal. The courses I took as undergraduate and graduate, by the way, were pretty bad and not very interesting. I must say, band theory, and it didn't seem at all exciting. For many years, I showed absolutely no interest in condensed matter, what is now called condensed matter physics. And that was reinforced by the culture at the time, certainly at Berkeley, but just about everywhere. And Berkeley, was at that point the center of high energy physics. It had the largest accelerator in the world for the time I was there, and there were experimental discoveries all the time, new particles. It was incredibly exciting. So there was really no question, never even considered, condensed matter physics. And it was partly, as I said, the nature, the culture at the time. Solid state physics was referred to by Murray Gell-Mann, who was one of the leaders of the field at the time, as squalid state physics. And that seemed to be the general consensus among the what we regarded as the elite theorists. This was, of course, historically a great mistake, but it was rectified by the end of the 60s, mostly due to Ken Wilson's work, which really formed the bridge between quantum field theory and condensed matter physics and renormalization group and phase transitions. But before that, I paid absolutely no attention.
In your Nobel lecture, you mentioned that the work of Giorgio Parisi on deep and elastic scattering was helpful in showing that there exist no asymptotically free field theories. Did you know Parisi at the time? Had you crossed paths?
Yes, indeed. I'm trying to remember when I first met Parisi. I discussed this recently with Giorgio. It wasn't so clear. Giorgio was a postdoc at some point in Colombia. I think it might have been a bit later. So I'm not exactly sure, but it was the early 70s, maybe 70, 71, certainly 72, 3. We overlapped. He was in New York. I was in Princeton. I used to visit Rockefeller. He visited Rockefeller. He visited Princeton. So I got to know him in the early 70s. The work that you're referring to, I mean, Parisi is an extremely broad and creative theorist who has worked in many fields. At that time, I think he was mostly interested in high energy physics. And I had, at that point that you're referring to, I had a detailed plan about how to deal with the scaling observed in deep and elastic scattering, which seemed extremely paradoxical. And my plan, I think, which was discussed in that that Nobel lecture, a biography you're referring to, or lecture, was essentially to explore, whether quantum field theory could possibly explain this. And the strategy was, I mean, by that time, it seemed that an obvious explanation of this scaling phenomena, or free field-ish phenomena as you went to higher and higher energies, was what we called later an asymptotically free theory, where the coupling gets weaker and weaker as you probe phenomena at shorter and shorter distances or higher energies. So my plan was, one, to show that that was necessary in quantum field theory, that in order to explain scaling, you'd really have to have asymptotic freedom. There couldn't be some kind of coincidence, or some kind of non-trivial fixed point that would exhibit the free field scaling that was observed. And then the other part of the plan was to explore all possible, if that was the case, one could explore any quantum field theory for the vicinity of weak coupling, which was required in the ultraviolet, and perturbatively explore whether you were driven towards weak coupling or away from weak coupling. So that was the plan, and part of the plan was to, which actually I regarded as the hardest part, was to really show that asymptotic freedom was necessary, a necessary condition if you accepted the data as indicating free field behavior or at slack. There weren't many people who believed in the slack data. I mean, Ken Wilson, who was in a better position than anyone perhaps to understand the implications, was of the opinion that, well, number one, the data wasn't conclusive. You can't believe it. And it's true, the data was pretty crummy at the time. The energies were remarkably low to expect anything, dramatic. And the error bars were very big and so on. So he sort of dismissed it because it didn't fall into his general philosophy, which I must say, I was never that convinced by that, I forget exactly how it went, but Kurt Callan, whom I was working with on this project, exploring, what was necessary to explain the kind of slack results. And I were aware of this paper of Parisi where he examined in a particular case, of a special case, the behavior of what we would call the anomalous dimensions or the scaling behavior of operators in the operator particle expansion that contributed to deep and elastic scattering. And that was what we did was generalize that result, apply it to just about all quantum field theories, with some exceptions, but to show that if you that to give an argument based on a kind of analysis that Parisi had done for a very special case was very general. And that it one of its consequences was that the theory had to be have a ultraviolet fixed point at the origin, and that implied asymptotic freedom. And we proved that for all quantum field theories, with the exception of non-abelian gauge theories, which were pretty, I think that was in 71, too, were rather new and unexplored. And our proof broke down for such things. And we now understand that a lot better, I should say, of course. So that was an important ingredient. It really completed part of my program, which was to show that, asymptotic freedom was necessary in quantum field theory to explain deep and elastic scattering. And the other part of the proof was, the other part of the argument was to show that, explore all possible quantum field theories and see if any are asymptotically free. The obvious ones that, the simplest theories one could write down, one could easily show were not asymptotically free, notoriously quantum electrodynamics, the phenomena of screening of electric charge in the medium of dipoles, a charge medium was the opposite of asymptotic freedom. And but what I wanted to do was prove this for any quantum field theory. And in the end, Sidney Coleman, who was visiting Princeton at the time, helped with a crucial technical insight, and I completed that with him, showing that there were no asymptotically free theories at all, except non-abelian gauge theories, which we didn't discuss. Again, our proofs didn't apply to that situation. So in general, what I expected was, and partly, this rhymes with my earlier interest as a young student at Berkeley, being fascinated by Jeff, my mentor, my advisor, Jeffrey Chu's belief that quantum field theory was not the right framework for understanding the strong interactions. So what I expected to show was that quantum field theory simply could not explain deep elastic scattering. One needed something else, a negative result. But that's what I expected would be the consequence. Asymptotic freedom was necessary. There weren't any asymptotically free theories. Kind of look outside of quantum field theory or something else. The final part, of course, was the discovery of asymptotic freedom. When with my first graduate student, we looked at Yang-Mills theory and discovered it was asymptotically free, and then everything fell into place because that could was the unique. What we effectively showed was that it was the only quantum field theory in four dimensions that could explain deep elastic scattering. So if you believe that, you had no choice, and QCD immediately followed from that discovery, plus everything else one knew about the strong interactions by at that point. But Parisi's work was very helpful in giving a clue as to how one might prove, as we did, that asymptotic freedom was necessary and
So,
not a coincidence.
following that work, you kept working on trying to solve QCD and then on what you describe yourself as speculative physics. What was generally driving your selection of problems? What was the overarching program, if you want?
Well, the over that yeah, the overarching program was still incomplete, I must say. Was so when we had QCD, it seemed like it was consistent with everything that was known about the strong interactions, and it could be tested precisely at deep elastic scattering. And so that was great, but there were a few technical problems or outstanding problems, and there was one deep conceptual problem, and that was quark confinement. Confinement was necessary in some sense, or No. Why didn't one see quarks? How come quarks weren't being produced? That was the overriding question that was worrisome, because otherwise it didn't make any sense to have a theory which was based on quarks, but there aren't any quarks, and how does that happen? And at the beginning, there was zero understanding of that, although we suggested, Frank and I, that the fact that the coupling becomes strong, the so-called infrared slavery, the opposite phenomena, as you go to larger distances, the coupling anti-screens or paramagnetic behavior of the quantum vacuum, because of now we have a quite a good physical picture of that because of the existence of charged gluon dipoles, magnetic dipoles, if you want, which made it quite different than QED, where the quanta, the glue, photons, are neutral under the gauge group. So this I thought was crucial. One, to make sure the theory made sense, agreed with experiment to the extent that you explained why you never produce quarks. And obviously, one, and it became very clear at the beginning, that in order to explain the behavior of the proton, the neutron, of hadrons, you had to dynamically generate a mass. And that was, again, something that was very new, to have a theory with, in effect, no masses, no scale. Scale invariance is broken by quantum effects, and that can, in the regime of strong coupling, produce a mass gap, and potentially, in effect, an infinite mass for the quarks. And so, I felt that, it was very exciting to make this discovery, to propose a theory of the strong interactions, but there was this conceptual and technical problem which was paramount. So that's what I devoted myself to for about 10 years. There were some other problems with QCD to begin with. I mean, the U1 problem, etc. There were a few technical issues, but they weren't extreme. Quark confinement, however, was.
So
It's still an unsolved problem, by the way. We've just started a Simons collaboration on QCD and confinement and QCD strings, and so that's a still remains an unsolved problem, which might take a might not be really completely solved or to our satisfaction in this century, but we hope so. In any case, that's what I devoted myself entirely to. Again, condensed matter physics was already a subject of great interest to me because of Wilson's work, which the renormalization group, which whose application was mostly at the beginning to his motivation or his application of these ideas was largely to phase transitions in condensed matter physics. So that had a very important historical effect reuniting the field of quantum field theory and high energy theory and condensed matter theory. And with remarkable benefit to both sides.
So it's in that context that you spent the academic year 83-84, I guess, on sabbatical at the Laboratoire de Physique Théorique of INS and the Service de Physique Théorique of the now CEA. What led you to these groups in particular?
So, well, I'd had a lot of over the years contact with the group at the École Normale, Bouchard's group, which had originally been at Saclay but then moved to the ENS. I forget exactly when. But when I was a postdoc at Harvard, a junior fellow, and later at Princeton, I would every once or twice, I guess. Well, no, by the 70s, many times, I would go to spend the summer in Europe, often at CERN for a bit, and the École Normale, which had a summer program every summer. And they had a group of people who would sort of come, and wasn't very organized, wasn't like a school, it was just a gathering. But it was a gathering in Paris, which was of really excellent people. Tini Veltman was always there. Sidney Coleman, Shelley Glashow, and so and I was by then good friends with Edouard Brezan, who was a postdoc. My first years at Princeton was a postdoc for 2 years, I think. Just at the time this revolution was happening, both in condensed matter and phase transitions, renormalization group, and later, same time, I think he was there at the time, QCD. So Edouard and I were good friends, and at Princeton, I took advantage of the fact that it was very easy to go on sabbatical every 3 years or so, because Princeton, being so rich, had a lot of sabbaticals, and the experimentalists couldn't use them, so the theorists could easily abuse the system, and I did. And so I planned to go to Paris and also to Israel for a full sabbatical year. I guess it was 83-4. The reason, aside from just wanting to spend a semester in Paris and work with my friends. But one of the main reasons was that by that time, my involvement in trying to solve QCD, et cetera, had petered out to some extent. It was just. Although a lot of progress had been made in developing QCD in many aspects, it was just too hard. And the other thing was that was more and more interested in unification. The standard model by that time, it was clear, was leading us to think about unifying all the forces. The extrapolation of the standard model suggested, and the particle content of the standard model suggested, a unification scale very high in energy, very close to the so-called Planck length, where gravity becomes important. So I was drawn, as were many of my colleagues, to think about unification of gravity and the other forces of nature. And that rekindled my interest in string theory, which I'd been interested in. Initially, when it was discovered back in 1968, and had worked on it very early on, and at Princeton with John Schwartz and two young French postdocs, Joel Sherk and André Nouveau, who were there, and that was very exciting. The dual resonance model, the Veneziano amplitude, and its generalizations. And I gave that up because I realized it wasn't going to solve the problem I was most interested in, which was deep inelastic scattering and the structure, the Strong interactions. But Andrea and I were good friends and colleagues, and we'd worked on problems famously. Right after QCD on a model, a two-dimensional model, which is very illustrative of how you dynamically generate mass in asymptotically free theories. And in any case, André was a close colleague and friend, and a string theorist, remained so over the years. And And I decided in 82, 83 to get back into string theory, which was a pretty neglected subject. It really was Green and Schwartz and a few others who were still doing, by that time, supersymmetric string theory. It's very interesting, but. And so my idea was to go into Andre and I were going to work together on string theory. Unfortunately, well, so this was all set up and I'd arranged this visit and then Andre accepted a position at CERN. He was offered I think it was at that point a 5-year position at CERN, but CERN was very attractive and he went to CERN. So that was very disappointing to me, but I still was going to go to Paris anyway. And but there were almost no string theorists in Paris. There were almost no string theorists anywhere in the world at that point. But Paris was Paris, so I guess one of your questions is about random surfaces.
Yeah, which I think is the first problem you tackled there.
Yeah, that was, you know, a way of trying to construct a different approach to string theory. If you want, the string theory is a theory of random surfaces. The world cheats, that the string maps out as it moves in time, describe a surface. And anyway, so that was a work directly related to string theory, which I.
But how did that collaboration with Alain Bidoire and Enzo Marinari begin then?
Well, you know, I was thinking about how to sum over random surfaces or path integral of, you know, two-dimensional geometry. And these guys were computer experts. Computers at that time were pretty trivial compared to today, but still, I was not at all adept in that, and so I enlisted them to try to. This project. But you know, I was at the École Normale and it was buzzing with all sorts of stuff, and so I started hearing about spin glasses, which seemed to me awfully interesting. And this was exactly the time where Parisi had put forward this mean field theory, applicable symmetry breaking solution, which absolutely intrigued me. I mean, this was something I'd never heard of. It seemed totally crazy and bizarre, but I learned about it from listening to talks or
So you had not kept in touch with Parisi since his time in New York, or even.
yeah, I'm trying to remember. You know, Parisi is quite a remarkable has a remarkable talent for noticing interesting ideas that occur here and there and then amplifying on them. So, for example, we overlapped in a whole variety of different areas. Iguchi Kawai was one of them, but I forget whether that was before. That was probably before that, for example. So, you know, I was always aware always would notice what Parisi did and what. So, but no, I never. You know, Parisi unfortunately doesn't travel that much, especially to the United States. When I was at KITP, I've tried to get him to come to Santa Barbara so many times, and so many times it was this close, but in the end, I don't think he's ever been here. So we didn't overlap that much now and then, no, what attracted me was just this crazy scheme of symmetry breaking and replicas, which were kind of this mathematical trick. So it's just fascinating stuff, and but I wanted to understand it much better, and it seemed very complicated, and I thought, well, the way to understand things, for example, the work I did with Novo was to find some kind of large n limit, some kind of limit where the number of degrees of freedom becomes very large, that often is a means that you have a classical limit of some kind with a small parameter, and you can often solve things exactly. And I again, that was one of the things I guess I learned about when condensed matter physics and high energy physics began to talk to each other, because this had been an idea that was often used in condensed matter physics, I guess, starting with Heisenberg's spin model and Stanley's work and others. And I use it, was happy to apply it to every possible hard problem that one could think of and have over the years, from two-dimensional QCD, which was a great example, which had Hooft used the larger limit to solve. And it was a great calculable example of quark confinement, to the so-called Gauss-Neveu model, which I talked about before. So anyway, it seemed to me, why not try to take this spin glass, which is such a simple Hamiltonian, and find some kind of large n limit instead of just having Ising spins on each side of the spin glass. And then I realized that, well, it's not gonna, spins don't, continuous spins don't work, but maybe some other kind of model, like the Potts model, would work. And I started discussing this. So, Parisi was in Rome. If he had been in Paris, I would have gone to Parisi, but instead I talked about this with Marc Mazar, and Marc was great to work with. So we started to look at the Potts model as a function of P, the P spin Potts model, where you have P variables on each side, and the and realize and pretty rapidly realized that that in that limit one could actually solve the theory. And well, one could explicitly examine Parisi's replica symmetry ansatz for large P, where it's simplified dramatically instead of having this complicated hierarchical order parameter. One had just a two-step order parameter. Everything was calculable. And Mark was also, one of the experts on spin. He'd been working on spin glasses a lot, and was part of this group around Parisi of Virasoro and
Lose and
Toulouse,
Solas, yeah.
Surlaps, yeah, right. And so, he taught me a lot about, well, like the TAP approach, et cetera, et cetera. And this went pretty fast because it was pretty simple once one started doing this. Showed that this we could understand the solution from the TAP equations as well. Not only that, it remarkably agreed with the random energy model that Derrida had postulated, which wasn't a microscopic model of a spin glass. It was a very cute idea of trying to construct a model where the energies are taken from some random ensemble. So the fact that the random energy model was equivalent to the large P spin Potts model made the random energy model real in a sense, and also gave a beautiful picture of what the spin glass looked like. So I really like this work a lot because I mean, I love soluble models that illustrate deep principles, and this was one of them. And
So, what
so
was the reaction to this work? I mean, was it immediately appreciated? Were the pairs, or was he only the cognoscenti who liked it, or?
the people who were into this game were in, again, very few. So it's always good to be in such a field where there are no very deep ideas, but only a handful of people know about them. And that was the case then. I mean, it was all new and complicated and mysterious and maybe wrong. It wasn't all clear. Yeah, so the group in Paris, I knew about it, was marginally excited, I guess. But they were, you know, there. This was a period where there were all sorts of avenues to explore, and people were exploring my friends in the, you know, in high energy physics, knew zero about all of this and hadn't any connection to it. You know, the second half of that year, I went to Israel. I was visiting Hebrew University, and there I, you know, I came right after this work and was very excited about it. So I gave some lectures, and sort of interacted with a whole group of quantum field theorists there, and some condensed matter physicists who were intrigued, and really, I felt I brought this to them. One of them was Sam Bilinski. Sam Bilinski had worked on spin glasses before, and that, you know, was very focused on this, very excited by Parisi's breakthrough. And there were another group of people who were more quantum field theorists who were interested in general quantum field theory, replica symmetry, and in particular in the Hopf field model. They went off and actually had distinguished careers, in the end, Sam Bilinski as well, in neuroscience, applying these ideas to the Hopf field model of memory, which was effectively a spin glass. But Sam Bilinski wanted to was very interested in this POTS model example, and said, "Why don't we look at it for finite p?" And that's led to this work with his graduate student Ido Kantor. He was at that time at Bar-Ilan University. I was at the Hebrew University. But Israel's a small place. And Chaim, you know, became a very good friend and colleague. And I enjoyed that work with him. And it was kind of remarkable that we could argue that this, you know, didn't really require p goes to infinity, but occurred. There was a phase transition as a function of p already for p equals 4. So that made it much more realistic. I guess I could have gone on in this game, but my real.
Before we move on, I had a couple of other questions. During your time in Paris in particular, did you cross path with Elizabeth Gardner, who was working a lot with Bernard Derrida at the time, or?
Derrida was rather aloof and removed from this, you know, he wasn't part of this. So there was a group of the people of Mézard and Sorlat and so on who were all, you know, very interconnected, but Derrida was, you know, off doing his stuff and not really part of this group. It's a different style of physics. He still does. It's very special and wonderful. But no, I didn't. I don't remember. I might have met Gardner, but I have no recollection.
And also, in your Nobel lecture, you referred to the early days of renormalization as the renormalization trick period. Was your
Well,
impression?
no, that was earlier.
Sure. But the question is, was there a parallel in your mind between the
Oh.
renormalization trick and the replica trick, meaning that there was lots
Now,
of
renormalization was a much deeper problem in a sense than replicas, than dealing with quench disorder. So renormalization was regarded by many as a trick. Famously, Feynman talked about, even though it was crucial to his work on quantum electrodynamics. I forget the quote, maybe I quoted it in that lecture. It was a trick. It was there was this feeling that that I learned by taking courses in quantum field theory as a student that renormalization was kind of a trick. It was a way to circumvent this, these ultraviolet divergences, and it worked, and it was highly non-trivial to prove that it worked. And if it didn't work, you were gone. So you had to only work with so-called renormalizable field theory. Very different the way we look today at quantum field theory. And there was never at that when I learned quantum field theory any understanding of what was behind this trick. What did it mean? What was the physics? And and that changed completely. That was the Wilsonian revolution that changed it. And to a large extent, the discuss QCD. I mean, the fact that you could have a theory. So, I mean, QCD was the first example, at least in four dimensions, of a theory which had no ultraviolet divergences. And,
So the question was, in the context of the early days of replica symmetry breaking, that did have at a different scale, admittedly, and a different energy scale also, right? Something of that, a bit of magic or that sidesteps difficulties,
Clearly
but.
was a mathematical trick and still is. It's still so replica symmetry as a trick, I guess Edwards and Anderson invented to deal with how to deal with quench disorder, how to average over the log of the partition function. How to regard the log as a limit of a power, which is a mathematical trick, for sure. Although, all mathematical, some mathematical tricks acquire a physical meaning of their own, exist in some kind of meta world. Has enormous applications because, of disorder in condensed matter systems. And nowadays, in quantum gravity and holography and string theory, replica symmetry is the trick is invoked in order to calculate entropies, which again are easily re better regarded as sort of the limits of Rennie entropies, which are kind of replicas. And just in the last year or two, it's had a, this, these tricks have enabled one to solve very deep problems in quantum information, black holes. It's a it, At the time, it was regarded by many people, maybe, well, certainly the more mathematically inclined people as a trick and as a dangerous trick. And it's kind of evident why it's so dangerous, especially for spin glasses, because that's taking a n go, n being the number of replicas to zero, which doesn't seem to make any sense, and there are all sorts of issues. And the perturbation theory around this mean field theory was full of nasty divergences and didn't seem at all normal. And still, you know, although now there are rigorous proofs of the existence of this phase, it still seems a bit dangerous and is indeed dangerous in many circumstances. So it's slightly different. It's hard to, at least I don't know of any way to understand, you know, in some physical context, the existence of these replicas. It seems still to be a trick to some extent. Although I must say the use of replicas in geometry where you have it has deepened the power of this trick. There one is taking not n goes to zero, but n goes to one typically, in order to calculate the von Neumann entropy is a kind of limit of replicas of the system or the Rennie entropies, but not in such a dangerous limit as taking the number of replicas to zero. One is much better than zero. So it's still to some extent, I'm not sure how, you know, whether there isn't more to put it on a firmer physical setting.
So you were mentioning that upon your return from Jerusalem, right, your interest, your enthusiasm for these models shifted, I think.
The models are still, I still was enormously like, well, two things happened. One is, first of all, I returned to Princeton and so that this, you know, this breakthrough of Parisi's breakthrough and its applications was really centered in Paris and in Rome, and had just spread a bit outside of that. So though, but second of all, you know, what I was really interested in, well, second thing, which I continued to do in Paris, was getting back into string theory. And when I returned, which was, I guess, 84, beginning of, well, so spring of 84, there was a big breakthrough of Green and Schwartz in that summer. And which was very exciting and made much more realistic the possibility of constructing a consistent theory at the supergravity, superstring level in 10 dimensions of chiral matter. And so I got, you know, that was even more exciting. It's maybe a different order of magnitude, at least for me. And so I only followed very peripherally the exciting developments that came out of replica symmetry breaking. And there were many. I mean, it really was amazing. But I really was an observer. I was totally focused on string theory.
At Princeton and around Princeton, there was Phil Anderson and the Bell Labs crowd. So were you at all, did you discuss with them at all at that point?
Yeah, Phil, of course, you know, was the Anderson of Edwards Anderson and invented, or together with Edwards, the replica symmetry. So he was absolutely fascinated, not technically in the sense that he got into it, but he found, you know. And so, he got me to give a colloquium on spin glasses. And you know, he was interested. Phil was not somebody, unfortunately, that I could collaborate with or work with. It was very hard to understand him, I must say, often. And he wasn't that much into spin glasses at the time, although he followed it and was very positive about it. But no, I was This was the super string revolution. This was enormously exciting. We discovered the heterotic string. It seemed that we had the, tantalizingly close to a complete unified theory of everything. I didn't have time, much time to do anything else.
So what was the subject of this colloquium that you gave in Princeton? I mean, you presented the work on the P-spin glass
No, I
or
mean,
something else.
well, this was a colloquium for the general physics department, so it was about spin glasses and replicas and replica symmetry breaking, and then also the simplest spin glass, because that's the simplest case for one, and the random energy model. I mean, don't know, I have the notes somewhere. Those were the days where one has transparency. Plastic, so I have those plastic things somewhere. It was a good lecture. It's a beautiful subject. I mean, and the ultrametric nature of this and its implication and so on. So it was a general talk on spin glasses with, but maybe the simplest spin gas was given as an explicit illustration, but it was a general talk in spin glasses.
In your Nobel lecture, you described American physicists as inveterate pragmatists, which affected how they initially responded to quantum field theory, for instance. Do you have that same impression about their response to replica symmetry breaking? Or do you, and do you see a difference between European and American physics in that context,
Used to
rooted
be
in that
more.
tradition?
Used to be more. I think not as much anymore. Well, a bunch of things have happened in high energy physics, of course. The time I was discussing then was before, we had real theories. Now we have an incredibly successful theory, and so the and the. I think I was referring to a time, more to a time where European theoretical physics was, one, not as strong, and very formal and mathematical, and dominated by people like Hogg and Yost others who were, mathematical physicists. And then there were phenomenologists, especially at CERN came underway, but there weren't the kind of intermediate quantum field theorists who were, which I regarded myself as one, not particularly interested in mathematical rigor, because one knew what was true somehow, even if one couldn't prove it. So that I think has changed by now. At that time, as far as I think it was there were certainly people in France who were very skeptical about replica symmetry breaking, because it seemed so mathematically bizarre and unproven and unrigorous and mean field theory and infinite range, and there was enormous skepticism about whether it applied to the real world, to real spin glasses and four dimensions, et cetera, et cetera. And that it's taken a long time, I to and a lot of mathematical rigor to dissipate, but it's still, not totally clear.
As director, oops, sorry.
But the I think it was true in the earlier period that American physicists were less concerned with mathematical rigor, and were more used to making bold assumptions or approximations, because one had experiment one could continually interact with. Whereas the European tradition is a little more formal and rigorous.
You mentioned that as director of the ATP, you tried to bring Parisi over many times. Is there any other way where you tried to promote or encourage ideas of replica symmetry breaking while in that position?
Not particularly. By that time, it had been more or less. I mean, it didn't need. We actually had a very good program that I did organize, and trying to get Parisi to come was part of that, which he had agreed to, but in the end didn't. But then Mark Mazar, my collaborator and friend, was helped organize, and that was an extremely exciting program at the time. But I don't think the field actually needed support. It was going strong in so many different directions. It really is fascinating how deep ideas in physics and theoretical physics have applications even outside of physics. And that's certainly been one of the thrusts of this Rome-Paris axis over the years.
Is there anything else you would like to share with us about that era that we may have missed?
Well, some feelings, at that time, I think that was, from the point of view of European physics, that was a very, that was a time where this Rome-Paris connection was very strong and very fruitful. And I'm a little sad nowadays because Italian physics is suffering so much, so underfunded, and so just any Italian physicist, young Italian physicist, upon some point early on, leaves Italy. That's it. The École Normale, I also, one don't think is necessarily what it used to be as well. And it's kind of sad because those, at that time, the École and Spinoza, the group in Rome, was enormous. It was incredibly strong. And they had, carved out their own area and dominated it. And it's just a pity to see it suffering as it is now in both places, I think. But more in Italy. I mean, Italy is just, it's very sad.
In closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
Great. Yeah, I'm sure I do. But they're not very well organized. And I don't have any well-formulated plans, whether the Santa Barbara or Princeton, or whatever. I suppose I should start thinking about that. One tends not to until it's too late.
Professor Gross, thank you very much for your time for this conversation.